top stories. Day 23 of Russia-Ukraine conflict. Heavy fighting is reported in the center of the southeastern city of Mariupol. Several Russian missiles hit near a major city in western Ukraine. The United States is ratcheting up threatening rhetoric over China's military and economic cooperation with Russia. Also ahead, Iranians prepare for the Persian New Year. A ceremony is held in western Iran to showcase the country's cultural diversity. We'll have a report from Sanandaj. Day 23 of the Russian conflict in Ukraine, the mayor of Lviv says Russia has fired missiles at the western city, with several hitting a plant near the airport.
There was a strike against the city of Lviv. Air raid warning system worked. I'm grateful to the armed forces as they reacted. Some missiles, which were launched from the Black Sea area, were intercepted. Four missiles hit an aircraft repair plant, as you already know.
Lviv officials have said no casualties were caused in the Russian missile attack. The city, located near the Polish border, has largely escaped Russian attacks in the past 3 weeks. That's while heavy fighting continues near the capital, Kiev. Mariupol and several other cities in the east and south remain under siege as well. Moscow says fighting is also ongoing in Mariupol between pro-independence forces and Ukrainian nationalists.
In Mariupol, Donetsk People's Republic's forces, with the support of Russian armed forces, are tightening the noose and fighting with nationalists in the city center.
The spokesman said pro-independence forces have taken control of over 90% of territory in another self-proclaimed republic, Luhansk. Earlier, Ukrainian officials said Moscow's military operation had largely stalled in recent days, citing heavy losses on the Russian side. Ukraine's defense ministry says Russia has lost over 14,000 servicemen since the conflict began. Moscow has not commented on that. A top UN official has called on the Security Council for a thorough investigation into deaths of civilians, including children, in Ukraine.
Between 24 February and 15 March, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights recorded 1,900 civilian casualties. The total consists of 726 people killed, including 52 children, and 1,174 injured, including 63 children. The actual number is likely much higher. Most of these casualties were caused by the use in populated areas of explosive weapons with a wide impact area. Hundreds of residential buildings have been damaged or destroyed, as have hospitals and schools.
The World Health Organization's chief also said there had been 43 attacks on Ukrainian healthcare, leaving a dozen people dead. He called such attacks a violation of international humanitarian law. Russia's envoy to the UN denied reports that Russian forces are targeting civilians. Vasily Nebenzia also dismissed reports that the Russians had shelled a theater in Mariupol and instead blamed it on Ukrainian nationalists. In the meantime, the Ukrainian government says 9 humanitarian corridors have been agreed for Friday to evacuate civilians. Tens of thousands have already left the country through the corridors since they were first announced on March the 3rd. The United States says China will bear responsibility if it supports Russia's military action in Ukraine. Washington says it's concerned that Beijing is considering directly assisting Russia with military equipment to use in Ukraine. The U.S. is also concerned that China could help Russia evade economic sanctions imposed by the West. U.S. President Joe Biden is set to speak with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping by phone later on Friday. Biden will make clear that the U.S. will not hesitate to impose costs if China backs Russia. That's according to Secretary of State Antony Blinken. China has denied plans of military assistance to Russia. The latest developments follow heightened tensions between Beijing and Washington over a host of issues, including trade. Now, Russia says most countries that either voted against Russia in the UN General Assembly or imposed sanctions against Moscow took those actions under U.S. pressure. Lavrov said the majority of the countries that voted against Russia in the last month UN General Assembly meeting imposed or will introduce no sanctions against Moscow. That's because, he added, those countries believe their ties with Russia are worth more than voting with the West for entirely propagandistic purposes. The top Russian official said his country has lost, quote, any illusion that it can ever rely on the West. Lavrov also accused the West of manipulating media, saying there is no independent media there. He also said Moscow's military operation in Ukraine is aimed at protecting civilians and removing any threats to Russia. Now, Britain's media regulator Ofcom has revoked the license of the Russian television channel RT to broadcast in the UK with immediate effect. Ofcom says RT could not be considered a responsible broadcaster. That's because, it says, all media providers in Russia are under pressure from the state. Ofcom has also cited RT's relationship with the Russian government as another reason for revoking its license. RT has called Ofcom's decision unfair and accused it of being a tool of the British government. The channel already vanished from British televisions after the European Union banned it on March the 2nd. The ban is part of sanctions Western countries have imposed on Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Moscow accuses the West of Russophobia. To other news now, another attack on bases hosting U.S. forces in Iraq. Several rockets have been fired into Al-Balad airbase, that is in the north of the capital, Baghdad. The Iraqi security media cell affiliated with the prime minister's office says four rockets fell in open areas in the airbase. It says the attack left no damage or casualties. No group has yet claimed responsibility. American military convoys, as well as their bases in Iraq, have come under frequent attacks over the past months. Such attacks have increased amid rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq, and those sentiments grew after the U.S. assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January 2020. Iran and the P4 Plus One group have almost concluded months of talks to revive the 2015 deal. As we will see in this next report, Iran says the deal is closer than ever, but has reiterated that the ball is in the West's court.
The fate of many months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the 2015 Iran deal hangs in the balance. The dialogue seems to face a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4 plus one group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax. But still, the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo. This week, Iran's top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the parties are closer than ever to a final agreement.
The Iranian government has made it very clear that the red lines that have to be respected and not crossed include a respect for Iran's missile program, which is well within its sovereign rights, a lifting of the brutal economic sanctions that have been placed on the Iranian nation and the Iranian people, and likewise for the guarantee that the United States would not remove itself and break the deal once again.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready for a final deal if its red lines are observed. He said a good and lasting deal can definitely emerge in Vienna if the United States acts realistically and refrains from making new and wrong demands. He made the remarks soon after a trip to Moscow, where he sat down with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The meeting came amid speculations that Russia's demands for written guarantees from the U.S. to ensure that Tehran-Moscow trade ties will not be affected by Western sanctions over Ukraine have complicated the Vienna talks. But the Iranian and Russian top diplomats made it clear that that is not the case.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Russia has created no obstacle to reaching a deal between Iran and the P4 plus one group in Vienna. He noted that Russia will remain by the side of Iran until the end of the negotiations. The Russian Foreign Minister announced Moscow has received the written assurances that it demanded.
During a joint press conference with his Iranian counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov ended speculations about Russian demands regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Azov, received written guarantees from Washington that Western sanctions will not prevent cooperation within the framework of the Iran deal. He noted that no illegal sanctions can stop the growth of Iran-Russia ties. The top Russian diplomat stressed that Moscow wants a quick revival of the JCPOA, and the Americans must return to the agreement and lift their illegal sanctions. The ball now seems to be in America's court if it is serious about reviving the JCPOA. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong. But Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem.
So one of the things that we have to be very concerned about is that the U.S. Unwillingness to agree that they will never leave the deal and resume coercive sanctions means that it is very likely that if another U.S. administration is elected, especially a Republican one that is more hawkish on foreign policy and more closely aligned with Israel, that they will leave the deal and reimpose sanctions on Iran. And one must be made very well aware of the fact that the Zionist lobby in the United States is extremely powerful.
Observers believe that the United States, as the party that abandoned the deal and threw the JCPOA in tatters, is expected to do more now that the negotiations have reached this critical stage. The coming days will probably show whether Washington will take the necessary political decisions.
The UN Security Council adopts a resolution to secure a formal presence in Afghanistan amid a deepening humanitarian crisis there. The Norway-drafted resolution includes several strands of cooperation, namely on humanitarian, political, and human rights fronts. Norway says the motion is crucial to respond to the immediate humanitarian and economic crisis in Afghanistan. It says the resolution will also result in peace and stability there. Afghanistan has experienced decades of fighting and a U.S.-led occupation. It's gripped by an economic crisis after many countries cut off their financial aid, and the U.S. even froze assets following the Taliban takeover last year. And Iran's province of Kurdistan has hosted a ceremony to welcome Nowruz, the Persian New Year. The event comes as a part of an initiative taken by UNESCO dubbed the Caravan of Nowruz, aimed at showcasing Iran's cultural diversity in marking the occasion. Youssef Jaloli reports.
From Kurdish horses to Kurdish music and dance, this festival is all about showcasing the traditions of Iran's province of Kurdistan in celebrating the Persian New Year known as Nowruz.
I wish you a happy Nowruz. I hope that the New Year will be treating you well and the COVID pandemic will be over.
I welcome all of my fellow Iranian citizens who have come to visit Sanandaj. I wish them health and wealth in the New Year.
The ceremony also saw Iranians coming from other provinces, both to get acquainted with the Kurdish culture and to showcase their own customs in celebrating Nowruz.
We've come from Sistan and Baluchistan province. I'm so glad to see all Iranian ethnicities have happily gathered here to celebrate Nowruz.
I congratulate you on Nowruz. I'm from Khorasan province, and today I watched the Kurdish dance, and it was amazing.
Nowruz marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, which falls on March 21st. The ancient tradition is celebrated by some 300 million people in Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan, among other countries. That's why this event has also hosted activists from other countries.
I congratulate the arrival of Nowruz to all nations that celebrate this occasion. We in Tajikistan also mark Nowruz magnificently, as it's a time for peace and friendship. I thank the UNESCO for organizing this event.
There is so much beauty in the way Iranians celebrate Nowruz. Each city has different traditions in marking Nowruz, and that is exciting. We in Afghanistan do share some of the traditions here.
Unlike Iran, in Afghanistan we don't have the haft-sin spread, but we do have haft-miveh, which is a spread with seven different fruits prepared on the turn of the year. I think we're here to celebrate these differences as they make Nowruz a diverse festivity.
Initiated by the UNESCO's Tehran office, the ceremony came as part of the caravan of Nowruz, which set out from the city of Hamadan, stopped in Kermanshah, and wrapped up in Kurdistan, bringing together representatives from each Iranian province to showcase their Nowruz traditions.
After visiting Hamadan and Kermanshah, the caravan of Nowruz arrived in Kurdistan province as the last stop. And on every step of this journey, the cultures, languages, costumes, and music were different. And that's just a small part of Iran's cultural diversity, which is now best reflected in Nowruz.
And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
New Year, Nowruz is almost here.
Join IRIBE English Radio on Sunday afternoon, 20th of March at 1500 hours GMT as we chime in the new year at 1533 GMT.
We celebrate Nowruz live on air on Sunday afternoon, March 20th, 2022, around the traditional haft-sin table.
We wish you a wonderful and prosperous Nowruz.
Limelight. Children seem to be facing increasing risks as mask mandates are abandoned and vaccination rates stall.
says Melanie Schreiber, reporter, in an article published under the heading, "One-third of all U.S. child COVID deaths occurred during Omicron surge." Stay tuned for more. As many as a third of all child deaths from COVID in the United States have occurred during the Omicron surge of the pandemic. Children seem to be facing increasing risks from COVID-19 even as mask mandates drop across the country and vaccination rates among children stall out at alarmingly low rates. We saw a massive surge of hospitalized young children during Omicron that we didn't see in the earlier months of the pandemic, said Jason Kane, a pediatric intensivist and associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Chicago Comer Children's Hospital. Since the beginning of the year, 550 children have died from COVID-19 in the U.S., compared with 1,070 children in the preceding 22 months, according to data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. The figures cover the group aged 0 to 17. Their fatality rate remains the lowest compared to other cohorts. Omicron was first identified in November and within weeks became the dominant variant in the U.S. Although Omicron is less severe than Delta, it is 3 to 5 times more deadly in the overall population than pre-Delta variants were, recent CDC research shows. The variant may also affect younger children in different ways than previous versions of the virus. Omicron tends to infect the upper airways, which in children are narrower and can be more easily irritated. Kane said, "Omicron really did something different than Delta, and I don't think it was just because more kids were infected." He saw younger patients with illnesses similar to croup and bronchiolitis, which can be dangerous in young children with a pediatric airway the diameter of a pencil, he said. "It's no longer fair even to insinuate that COVID doesn't affect children. That COVID deaths are only in unhealthy children or kids with risk factors. That's just not true by the data." The under 5 age group saw record high hospitalizations over the past few months. Omicron hospitalization rates for kids under the age of 5 soared 5 times higher at Omicron's peak than during the Delta wave, according to recent CDC research. Among all ages of children, those under 1 may face the highest risk of severe disease, yet they're not able to take many of the precautions available to older people. Children under 2 cannot wear face masks, and children under 5 are not yet eligible for COVID vaccination. Nearly 5 million children have been infected with COVID in 2022, and cases are now sharply declining. The majority of children who become infected with COVID have mild cases, and they are the population with the lowest death rate. That may change as variants evolve and emerge, Kane called it the million-dollar question. "Omicron has been very bad for kids. We don't know what future variants will do," said Julia Rafman, assistant professor at the Boston University School of Public Health, who flagged the sharp uptick in Omicron deaths, adding, "We don't have a good enough understanding of what protection there is from prior infection, how long it lasts, how robust it is." In the coming months, Rafe Mann said, we will see a lot more infection and more cases will always mean more hospitalizations and deaths, especially with low vaccination rates. Florida Surgeon General recently recommended against vaccinating healthy kids given the possibility of side effects, which remain extremely rare and are outweighed by vaccines' protection. Vaccines are highly effective against severe illness, hospitalization, and death for eligible children, but less than 30% of children between the ages of 5 and 11 are vaccinated in the U.S., and a little more than half of children between 12 to 17 are vaccinated. Preventive measures like masks should stay in place at schools and daycares, as well as parents' workplaces and public transportation, in order to protect children as long as the virus is circulating, Rafeman said. She added, the kids who are too young to wear masks really need other people to reduce transmission around them. Requiring face masks in schools during the Delta wave last fall helped reduce COVID cases by 23%. According to CDC research published recently. A nationwide child vaccination campaign is very important as well, Rafeman said, especially one in multiple languages that focuses on low-income communities where not enough families have gotten vaccinated. COVID has hit marginalized communities harder, and vaccination rates and access to medical care tend to be lower in the same communities, creating a double whammy, Kane said. Vaccines provide some protection against infection, which helps keep the virus from spreading, and they also offer excellent protection against hospitalization and death. Vaccinating and boosting those who are eligible would help protect children too young to be eligible themselves, as well as providing other important benefits, Rafeman said. We have never achieved high enough vaccinations in the United States. We lag far behind other countries, and it makes us really vulnerable to continued high rates of death, hospitalization, social disruption, and economic disruption. And death are only one measure of COVID's effects, she said. Long COVID is also a concern for kids. The record high hospitalizations are concerning for kids. Amid the fear and exhaustion of the Omicron surge, Kane's overwhelming feeling was frustration because proven measures are available to keep many children from becoming severely ill or dying. He said, kids shouldn't die. Kids shouldn't die.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Stand here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Women in the U.S.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in this episode, we're going to speak about women in America. What are the problems women face in the workplace and society? What has been done to address inequality and discrimination towards women? Are women safe? What are the issues of single mothers? And what are some issues African-American women face in society as well? Today, we are pleased to have our two special guests on our show, Oniyosunwa Chatoyor, editor at Hood Communist and organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and Yemi Belechu, who is director of operations for People's Programs based in Oakland, California.
Women in different social movements have been fighting for their rights in the United States for a very long time. Depending on the movement that spearheaded the fight for women's rights, the success might have played in the hands of the corporate elites of the American capitalistic society.
So this is one of the reasons that despite long, hard struggle of American women today, many problems still persist. Violence against women is rampant and most see no clear solutions. So what are some of the problems women in America are facing today, ma'am?
A culture of abuse. We experience it, objectification, exploitation, starting from childhood. It continues even into the domestic realm. There's a very, very high incidence of domestic violence, particularly within poor and working class communities in the United States. And then like the places that we can turn to for so-called justice, like the police, oftentimes have the same problem. Police have extremely high incidence of domestic violence within police agencies. They also have patriarchal attitudes that makes them disbelieve women who are victims. So basically it's like a culture of impunity while domestic violence and sexual abuse are happening.
Now, according to the RAINN Institute statistics, that's RAINN if you want to check it, every 68 seconds, an American is sexually assaulted. Also, one in five or 20% of women in America have been victims of complete or attempted rape. These are just numbers. No number, though, can show the true effects of violence towards women, a third of which were below 18 years of age at the time of assault. American society is truly not a safe place for women and children who are the more vulnerable. So why is sexual assault so prevalent in America today?
Yeah, I think that you see, what you said is really right. And I think exploitation, so interpersonal exploitation, right, is kind of base, which is what sexual assault is, right? It's interpersonal levels of exploitation. And that's best based in, you know, patriarchy, which is another aspect of capitalist, you know, a capitalist government, a capitalist economic system, which continues to divide us, right, not only by class, but also by gender and by race. And I think additionally, you know, a lot of the statistics around sexual assault have to do with lack of trust in the police state, right, and traditional forms of seeking justice. And so, you know, out in the United States, you know, there's around 2 out of 3 sexual assaults that women experience go unreported. And I think a lot of that has to do, right, not only with objectification, but also just like no means of accountability that actually changes the material impact of the women, right? So they experience sexual assault, but you know, what is going to happen if they try to seek justice for it? They're either going to be ignored or themselves will be criminalized further that by the system. I think, you know, another aspect of you said with the objectification of women, I think, yes, women are treated as object. Black women especially are commodified.
In the American capitalistic society, women are objectified in popular culture, the media, cinema, music, advertisement, billboards, and even at the workplace. While some, especially outside of the country, believe that women in the U.S. are free to dress and act the way they like, they do not see the pure pressure on women to dress sexually in society and sometimes are forced to do so at work.
Definitely think so. Like, even if you look at the media that's popular in the United States, whether it's the music, whether it's the movies, whether it's the television shows, you see like sexualization and objectification of women starting at a very, very young age. We see women being casually denigrated, being called slurs throughout the media and having it played for a joke. So it's absolutely a culture that celebrates denigrating women.
In 2018, a Thomson Reuters survey found the United States among the 10 most dangerous places for women. It ranked third when expert respondents were asked where women most risk sexual violence, harassment, and coercion into sex. This survey reiterated that the U.S. is one of the least safe places in the world for women. Is America really safe for women?
No, we're not. We're not safe in America. We are subject to abuse in all circles of our lives, in our families, in our relationships, at work. Even like just waiting for the bus is a risk for us because, again, the society builds a culture of impunity around denigration of women, around patriarchy, around our objectification. And so what that means is that you are not safe anywhere. You can't walk alone at night. You have to be careful everywhere you go. It's like think through possible scenarios where you might get hurt, where you might get victimized, and what you'll do. It's a very exhausting experience, to be honest.
Now, since the economy is the number one goal and objective in American society, and people are required to compete to get ahead in life, many women have also come to believe that if they are raising children or making a home, they are worthless, and in order to succeed, they need to abide by cultural norms which have been set out for them, essentially turning them into commodities.
Another aspect of you said with the objectification of women, I think, yes, women are treated as object. Black women especially are commodified in a lot of different ways. I think one way is just, you know, sexually, definitely through popular culture, right? Through media, it's always this hypersexualization. But I think that ties back to the understanding of, you know, how we are seen in this system, and it's seen as, you know, our value is tied to sexual, our value is tied to unpaid labor, you know, homework, things like taking care of your family, taking care of these different things. And there's just a lack of valuing Black women in a capitalist system, or undervaluing them in order to continue to exploit them unjustly. And I think it goes hand in hand. Sexual assault and harassment goes hand in hand with exploitation. But it's acted out in that more interpersonal level.
In the economic and labor sector, although an increasing number of women are either the sole breadwinner for their family or share the role with their partners, women in the United States are paid only 77 cents for every dollar a man makes. The pay gap is even larger for African American women, where on average they get paid 64 cents for every dollar a white man makes for the same job.
I think, one, since the beginning of this, you know, of understanding what capitalism is, the type of women, the type of work that Black women do, right, caregiver, keeping up the home, right, family, logistical work, is seen as less valuable, right? And especially Black women. And then there's an additional layer there. And I think really the foundation is that this capitalist system, these jobs are created to be exploited. And since the white supremacist capitalist system is built by white people, ultimately you see these billionaires, you see these Jeff Bezoses, the Amazons, who are ultimately going to create a system that benefits them the most. Therefore, women being paid less is just another form of exploitation to increase profit for those people. And I think Black women and African women experience that double exploitation, which is they are Black, right? Which is another method of exploitation under capitalism, and they are women. Therefore, they're paid less, they are valued less than their white counterparts, even though they're doing the same exact type of work, even though they're continuing to, you know, either they're working in those same jobs, which is, you know, could be any job and they're getting paid less, or they are working in, you know, blue collar jobs and continuing to be exploited at really higher rates than anyone else. So I think it has to do with the way the system values human beings as a whole, and then how the way the system of capitalism specifically exploits Black women, you know, in these systems and devalues their work and their labor.
My name is Sophia Cotton. Mommy. I'm a single mom. Mm. I make $230 to $240 every 2 weeks. I've been working there for almost a year. raised since I started working here. They have a slow week, you go home every day. I came into work one morning, I had to be there at 7. And once the general manager came in, she came in like 7:30, 8 o'clock, and she was like, okay, well, Sophia, you can clock out. And I'm like, well, I just got here. She's like, oh, well, we don't need you, labor's high. You can go ahead and clock out. It was not really matter to them if we making our hours and getting paid. I got 261 in food stamps last month.
After years of struggle, the Equal Pay Act was passed in 1963 so that men and women be paid the same when they're doing the same job at the same place. The jobs need not to be identical, but similar. Even though it has been years since this law was passed in the Kennedy administration, women still get paid substantially less than men, and they often fill less paying jobs. This is especially the case for African American and Latin American women. How can these conditions be improved?
Part of the reason is the lack of an organized workers' movement in the United States. Even if you are hired at a job, you're discouraged from organizing with your coworkers, from communicating about salaries and pay, which oftentimes has the impact of hiding deep inequalities for a long, long time. And so what women need to do is join efforts to unionize and build collective power among workers, because that's how we're going to force the improvement of our conditions.
Women in America are also allowed and take jobs which were once considered as a job solely for men and still are in many countries around the globe. American women sign up for the U.S. military and take different roles in all U.S. Armed Forces divisions. Now, statistics published by the New York Times show thousands of service women are sexually assaulted in the military every year, and most cases are swept under the rug by the commanding officers. The newspaper reported last year that there is an epidemic of sexual assaults in the U.S. military.
Well, the military is a really clear example of what I've been trying to talk about, like this culture of impunity in the United States. Like, women are told that we are equal to men in that particular context, but when women enlist in the U.S. military, they oftentimes face an extremely high rate of sexual abuse, again happening within a culture of impunity. The woman is more likely to be punished or dismissed in a context where she is abused sexually within the military than the perpetrator himself. It's the same thing in so many other workplaces, whether it's like migrant farm work, whether it's service industry jobs, whether it's administrative jobs. Like, this is what women are facing across industries. And at the same time, we have that lie of representation that says women should aspire to be like people like Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris or any number of women who occupy positions within a system that's exploiting all of us.
The COVID-19 pandemic has also caused major issues for women in the country. Interestingly, polls in the United States have shown that mothers working from home during the pandemic have reported higher rates of anxiety, depression, and loneliness than fathers. This displays how the role of mothers has drastically changed throughout the years in a capitalistic society. Last year, 3 million women dropped out of the workforce, and 1.6 million of them have still not returned.
Part of the organizing work that I do with People's Programs is direct service work with our Hot Meals program, which means we're giving hot meals out to homeless people and unhoused people here in Oakland, California. And, you know, we see Black women on the street every day, and they have no access to water, food, shelter, and health care. And I think there's a common misconception that because we live in the richest country of the world, the United States, that we have access to these human rights. But I see every single day, Black women and Black people suffering under capitalism, meaning they don't have their basic needs met. And I think that this country has a really good way of masking that by showing certain Black people in positions of power. But the masses of Black people, the Black women in that masses are living on the street, are experiencing extreme poverty. You know, you can go from the folks who are homeless to folks in our grocery program that we feed and deliver free groceries to. You know, single mothers in those programs are working 70 hours a week trying to take care of their children and their families, and being exploited not only through their labor, but also, you know, through the family structure of not being able to sustain and take care of their communities. I think you touched on this earlier, but, you know, there's a lot of medical apartheid that is happening in this country, especially to Black women who are dying at birth, who are giving birth, who are experiencing higher rates of high blood pressure, higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of other health issues that are preventable, right? But without access to the healthcare system or adequate access to the healthcare system, they're continuing to suffer under these different situations. And so I think being poor and underprivileged in the United States is basically being criminalized and neglected and being, you know, actively exploited at every point in your life here. So I think for women, they fall under it, especially for Black women. They're continuing to be exploited, especially poor Black women here in the United States.
Western society's dominant view on women and culture as a whole and norms of a capitalistic system are mostly to blame for the unfortunate and sad situation of women in America. Modern ignorance, which is spread in all aspects of Western life, objectifies women and makes women a commodity for the enjoyment of men, either as sexual objects or as low-income workers, making the rich richer. And now it's that time, everyone. We check in with Abbas Montarim to get his take on the story.
What's going on, my people, and welcome back to Power to the People. Today on the show, we're going to discuss some of the revolutionary history of Black students and how Black students have been essential in the Black radical tradition. So let's get into it, you feel me? Thank y'all for rocking with me. So we must understand that Black students have been an integral part of movements seeking to end Euro-American colonial domination. In the Civil Rights Movement, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, often referred to as SNCC, was formed to organize the Black community in the racist Jim Crow South. SNCC organized student-led sit-ins at segregated lunch counters, as well as boycotts, protests, and voter registration to combat Jim Crow-era voter disenfranchisement. They also organized what they called Freedom Summers, in which hundreds of students, volunteers, went into Mississippi for mass voter drives, as well as establishing freedom schools for Black youth. This organizing led to racist violence from the state and vigilantes. SNCC members were regularly harassed, beaten, murdered, and brutalized by law enforcement and the Ku Klux Klan. And we know that members of the KKK were also cops. The violence of white supremacy, as well as the lack of change through the so-called bourgeoisie democratic electoral process, it led to some of SNCC's members radicalizing and beginning to reject the nonviolent stance of the civil rights movement. One of these members was none other than Stokely Carmichael, who was later known as Kwame Ture. Kwame Ture, he popularized the phrase Black Power and advocated for the complete independence of our people, as well as picking up arms to defend ourselves from colonial violence, as we know it is our human right to do so. A'Trac Brown, who later changed his name to Jamil Al-Amin, he then became the leader of SNCC. He took the N for nonviolence out of SNCC and replaced it with the N for national. He also made a public alliance with the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, and ended up joining the Black Panther Party as well. We must understand that this was a natural evolution for Black student organizing, and it became more militant due to the conditions of this racist, white supremacist violence that Black students was facing. Black students began arming themselves to defend themselves from white terrorism. One example of this was the Black Panther Party, as the party evolved out of the Black student movement as well. Both Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who co-founded the Black Panther Party, they were both students when they met at Merritt Junior College in North Oakland, California. while they were students, they co-founded the Seoul Students Advisory Committee, which is the predecessor of the Black Student Union. And today, there's BSUs at colleges and high schools throughout the whole country. The Oakland Police Department, they was regularly harassing, brutalizing, and murdering Black people. And Huey and Bobby, they founded the Black Panther Party to combat this violence from the police. The first recruit to the Black Panther Party was 16-year-old Lil Bobby Hutton. And their junior college, Merritt College, has served as a recruiting ground. And one of their first actions was to legally start patrolling the pigs while carrying shotguns. And they were some real boys. The Black Panther Party is also responsible for helping create Black Studies. As point 5 of the 10-point program said, they wanted a true education for their people. And at Merritt College, Black Studies was created due to Black student organizing. And the first chair of the department was Melvin Newton, who was a member of the Black Panther Party and Huey Newton's brother. And now if we look at Black Studies today, there's Black Studies departments and African American Studies departments all throughout the country. And this is because of the Black militant students who paved the way for a whole new department to exist. We must pay a homage to this militant history. And today, Black student movements, they have been fighting to end colonial violence. When I was a student at UC Berkeley, we was organizing when we fought for 10 demands for institutional change. We shut down the campus' biggest restaurant and blocked off the entrance to the school on its biggest recruitment day. All of this organizing led to the creation of the Fannie Lou Hamer Black Resource Center, which is a vital hub for Black students to not only study out of, but to begin to organize. We also forced the University of California school system to divest $30 million from these private prisons. And it isn't just Black students in America who've been fighting back against racism. Black students across the world have been fighting back. In South Africa, students organized the Roads Must Fall campaign, which called for the removal of the statue of the genocidal terrorist named Cecil Rhodes, who was a British colonialist and the so-called prime minister in Cape Colony. South African students also organized a campaign called Fees Must Fall in response to a 10.5% tuition increase. And they were successful as African students organized en masse to stop institutions from increasing tuition. Black students are fundamental for the revolution. As Huey Newton said, the youth inherit the revolution, and Black students must realize and actualize their role in revolution. As Julian Luther King said, students must recognize that their education is not solely for individual gain and pleasure, but rather for the building of minds to serve the movement and the nation. And that nation being the new African nation. This is Power to the People.
Well, that was our program, everyone. Thank you for joining us. And I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And do tune in next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.